Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday, the 18th of February. A delight to have you with us. A cold morning, but a morning that we're waiting for more snow. We just heard Ray give the forecast, but we're just thrilled that you're with us. It's been a good week. We want to keep it that way. We have a lot to discuss. We'll get to it. We have a fantastic panel. I'll introduce them to you in a minute. If you would like to be a part of our discussion, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll get to your letters eventually. We can't get to all of them, but we'll certainly do our best, and we just ask that you keep them short and to the point, and that helps us in that matter. All right. Let's go to the group here this morning. Alan Shartok, first and foremost. Hello, sir. How are you? Hello, Alan. First and foremost, and yet...
Here I am. I was eating a tangerine, so I turned it down. stop that first and foremost thing. I'm just a humble nothing. And I did want to tell you I was out in the snow this morning around 4:30, the snow was covering up the ice, and it wasn't a good thing to do. But that's all I have to say for now.
You're okay.
Absolutely. I did not fall, but I did walk a little slower.
Well, that's all right. You know, it's as long as you get to the finish line, right? That's all that matters.
Said the hare to the turtle.
That's right. Exactly. Publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, is here. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
I am well, Joe, but I want to channel Rodney Dangerfield. I'm okay today, but boy, was it rough yesterday. I tell you, it was rough yesterday. It was the day after I had gotten the second dose of the COVID vaccine, and as the nurse told us and as friends told us, the second one you take with you a little bit more so than the first one. Today is better, and I don't want to discourage anybody from getting that vaccine. As soon as you can get it, get it.
Yeah, indeed. I had a relative who had the second shot this week and was very ill and for like 24 hours and then said, okay, all better and, you know, still worth it in the end.
That's pretty much it. So it's like having a slight case of the flu and the very sore arm.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you're on the mend. I'm glad you're here. Thank you for channeling Rodney. I appreciate it.
Yes, that was the highlight of the show.
I thought Ira was talking about the taping of the media project this morning, which was, to say the least, really, really got into it. It was me against them, as usual.
Contentious. Contentious. All right. Well, we look forward to hearing the program as always. We welcome back a Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, who is with us. Malia, thank you very much. We loved having you the first time, and I'm embarrassed that it's taken so long to have us back that pesky impeachment got in the way. But I thank you very much for being back.
I'm so pleased to be back. And actually, you did invite me back, and I wasn't able to come on the first day you asked me because I was going in for my second COVID shot that day.
Okay. Now I feel better.
In other words, she said to you, Joe, I have other plans.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, she's getting her shot. That certainly trumps all, pardon the pun. Okay. Linda Ellerbe is back, Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist and our dear friend. Good morning, Linda. How are you?
I am just fine. Obviously, I did not go to Mexico, so I am enjoying the glorious winter here.
Well,
why didn't you go to Mexico?
She said with a smile. I did not go to Mexico because although I generally go to Mexico for part of or all of the winter as much as I can at this age, and I'm retired, I didn't go this year because for obvious reasons. I didn't go because this... COVID was not good there. It was not good here, and traveling between there and here was not a good idea. And we decided to wait until we could be vaccinated. Ira, I have a question. Which vaccination did you get, Pfizer or Moderna?
Yeah.
Moderna. I have been vaccinated for my first vaccination. I've had my first one. I get my second one next week. It is Pfizer. I'm prepared for more consequences. I had no side effects from the first one. Rolf is unable yet to get his, although he has an appointment for his first one. It has not been a good situation here in Massachusetts. As people who live here in Massachusetts know, it's been quite troublesome. and not well handled, but that seems to be the case in every state in the United States.
It's so much better here in New York.
Every state has messed it up in their own way, in their very own way.
But I can say...
Having no national policy and leaving it up to each of the governors. Golly gee, what a surprise.
But I can say and should say that I love what our Fairview Hospital has done here. Organized,
terrific. Fairview has been fine. Charlie Baker has not.
That's a different story.
You and I will have a disagreement on that one, Alan, truly. When you're behind Mississippi and West Virginia in Massachusetts, and when the governor doesn't seem to think that the state west of Springfield actually exists, you got a problem. It's not been easy to register. It's not been easy to find out what's going on.
We do have a disagreement.
It has everybody who lives in Massachusetts is kind of aware that it's been real bad.
Yeah, but I mean,
not me, not everybody, not Alan, not Roselle.
I know, Alan, right now. But you have a special relationship with governors that many of us don't have.
That is absolutely fallacious and wrong.
All right. Jim Handler is here. Save me, Jim. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Jim Handler, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. In fact, as soon as we get off the radio today, I'm heading up to SUNY to get my second shot.
Oh, there you go.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Now, clear your calendar for tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, all I got tomorrow is a presentation to the president of the university. But other than that, I'm not.
Well, she'll understand. No, probably not, but you can give it a shot. Good morning, everybody, and welcome. It's nice to have you all here again. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So I'm going to start with the Cuomo story because it has something to do with what we were talking about as far as, well, obviously COVID and the state's response to it. So now legislators are moving to strip him of pandemic powers. And they are challenging the governor, Democrats challenging the governor in his handling of virus-related nursing home deaths. And the governor also faces now, we learned late yesterday from our Friends of the Times Union, a federal inquiry into what's going on. The move comes as it emerged that the FBI and the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York has opened an inquiry into the Cuomo administration's handling of nursing homes during the pandemic. It was not known whether the inquiry, which was confirmed by three people familiar with the matter, was focused on Mr. Cuomo or any individual, only that it was in its earliest stages. The inquiry was another clear indication of how the climate has shifted dramatically for Governor Cuomo since March, when he emerged as a prominent voice in the health crisis, using his daily briefings and invocations of his family to inform and calm a nation of viewers who turned to him as the virus began to spread. Now, much of that goodwill has evaporated. Then we get into the other story when he's now in a fight with Assemblyman Ron Kim, a Queens Democrat. This spilled out into the public yesterday as Governor Cuomo singled out Assemblyman Kim, who had said that the governor had threatened him last week, an accusation that the governor's staff was a lie. Earlier this week, a group of Assembly Democrats, including Mr. Kim, circulated a letter among colleagues seeking support for the revoke of Mr. Cuomo's powers that suggested the administration had broken federal law, an accusation the governor stridently denied on Wednesday and went on to say that his fight with Assemblyman Kim is a long one. It goes back many years, and also went into some detail as to some of the misdeeds that Assemblyman Kim allegedly did several years ago. So it's getting messy, Alan.
I knew you were going to call on me today first. You know, yesterday I wasn't good enough to call on first, but today, because it's Cuomo,
I called on you first almost all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Not yesterday, but I keep track of these things. Like
really,
like Cuomo,
I'm sorry.
like Cuomo keeps track of things.
Yeah.
Okay, I got a couple of things to say here, Joe. We all love you, and you know that. Much of the goodwill you read in that story, it was from the Times or the Washington Post, has been dissipated. I don't think so. So far, we still see huge positive ratings for the governor. The last time it came out, which was the Siena poll, and that was before a lot of this happened, you got 55%, which is humongous in politics. You had a president, a past president, who's left us now for a while, who never got above 50%. So that 55% was something. Secondly, comes this message from Kim and others about powers. I find that fascinating, you know, because here's why. The legislators themselves couldn't wait to give Cuomo the powers he wanted or that he needed because they wanted to stay home and be safe. Now that things are letting up a little, all of a sudden they're saying he grabbed these powers and we have to take them back. No, you gave him those powers, and you gave him those powers willingly and because you were concerned about yourselves. So I want to say that. And then a word to Andrew. Okay, Andrew, I'm not your advisor. And in fact, you haven't come around for an interview for a long time. And so I have no good reason to say anything good about you. However, I have a good idea for you. Keep your mouth shut. Don't start fooling with people like Kim. What do? You raise them, you elevate them, and you make yourself look petty. Don't do it. You know, you're the governor. You've got you were given high grades for the way you handled all of this in the beginning, at least. So just shut up. That's all I have to say. Is that enough?
That's enough. Ira Fussfeld.
Well, you know, as long as I've been reading and watching and talking to politicians, it never ceases to amaze me how the line about the cover-up is worse than the crime comes to the fore. I mean, this is a self-inflicted wound. I think that there are people in the state and in the legislature, both parties, who have been waiting for Cuomo to trip up like this, and they're going after him. The bullying tactics of Cuomo are not new, and I suspect those, you know, there've been ill will harbored for many years. But it just stuns me how this has come to be what it is, because it didn't have to be. If he had reported the numbers correctly from the outset, who would have blamed him? But, you know, the COVID was a scourge, is a scourge. And, you know, to feel the need to cover up the numbers, even if you're reporting the overall death numbers correctly, is just a silly misstep. That's all I can – it's probably a stronger word, but I'll just go with silly misstep.
But you know what, Ira? You're exactly right. He shouldn't have done it. He should have just – done what he did in the beginning. That's where he got all the high marks, in contrast to what Trump was doing. He told the truth about everything, no matter how uncomfortable. And you are absolutely right. This was silly.
Jim Henler.
So, you know, I think Ira is right. Boy, we're all agreeing today. But, you know, the one thing I almost feel like Chris Churchill must have felt yesterday defending Texas. let's not forget, though, that New York has come through this so much better than so many other states, where the governors refused to believe in science, rushed to open, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we had a bad spot at the beginning that put us up front, but we've done amazingly well comparatively since then. And it's just frustrating to see Cuomo, you know, shooting himself in the foot and then getting this, you know, circular firing squad, as Alan often refers to it, of, you know, in the Democrats in New York. We're going to, you know, give stuff back to the Republicans this way. And I don't know what'll happen, but, you know, it really seems like just a self-inflicted wound, and I'll just stop there.
Malia, what do you make of this? We have about a minute and a half.
Now, well, I think extraordinary powers are necessary in some situations, but they should always be used very sparingly. So even if Cuomo hadn't made a misstep, and I'm sympathetic to the difficulties of, you know, counting complicated statistics in a pandemic, but nonetheless, it's obviously a misstep. But even if he hadn't made a misstep, I think it would be time to be looking at whether these powers need to be curtailed.
Wynn Dellerby, we have about a minute.
I basically agree with Ira and Alan on this one. about Cuomo. I think it was a foolish mistake. I think the man has tried very hard and overall has done a tough and good job for the state of New York. I do not think that has happened with Charlie Baker in Massachusetts. Those are my comments.
and why we love you. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue on this subject, and we'll move on to others as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to be a part of our conversation, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's go to some letters on this subject. Jay writes, this Cuomo mess all got started when Cuomo started dissing Trump and began looking presidential on the national stage. Then the Trump camp came up with the untrue assertion that Cuomo's making sick patients go back to nursing homes was causing more deaths. If you fact check this, you find out that it was optional for the hospitals to send patients back if they felt they were no longer infectious. This has always been about the Republican long game of making Cuomo look bad so he won't be a viable candidate in 2024. Alan, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a real possibility. We know there was no love lost between the two guys. Cuomo has made that clear to me and to others many, many times. We know that Trump has no favorites, right? He only has one favorite. That was him. And therefore, you know, it makes sense that anything that he could do to embarrass Cuomo. But I think it extends to more than that. It extends, as I said before, to a bunch of ambitious politicians who think it's time to kill the king. He's running for he'll run for a fourth term. They can't move up. They want to move up. We know it, and we've seen it before. And I suspect that's really what's going on here.
Ira?
Well, I defer to Alan's expertise on state government. I think, there's a it's a long time between now and the next national election, presidential election. If we presume Biden is a one-termer, there might be an opening. And I think Cuomo has hurt himself on a national level where people are not nearly as familiar with what's going on in New York, and will be reminded of this scandal forever. I think within New York State, I think there's less likelihood of this having damaged him long term. Although, as Alan points out, he has been in office for a long time. It's a blue state, so a lot depends on who might be running against him if he were to run again. But I do think that it has the potential to have worn people out. And in New York, and that it might be a death knell for him. But I'm less confident in that opinion as I am about on the national level. I think he's hurt himself significantly on the national level.
Well, as you know, Ira, a couple of years, a year, a month, 2 months in politics is an eternity. Yeah, this will go away as other things have gone away. Now, we do know that there are people who are sitting down there who are really ticked off that they can't move up because the governor won't move out. And the governor can't be president, in my opinion. I don't, I've made missed calls before. But remember that Harris is the vice president. Everybody expects her to be the first female president of the United States. I doubt very much that Andrew Cuomo is going to go into a primary against Kamala Harris. I think it's not going to happen. I think he might like to, but I don't think he can do it now. Anything can happen between now and then. They're after her now. They're making accusations about her. One idiot is saying that she should be impeached now. So anything can happen. But I don't think we should be playing presidential politics about Andrew. I say he's going to survive this and that those people who are out to get him are going to fail.
So, Alan, I think I know you well enough that I don't have to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Please.
We have three letters. Two are complimentary to you. One is not. Which would you like me to read first?
Not.
Okay.
Not.
That's exactly what I thought. Okay. Allen insisted in the past week or so that, yeah, mistakes were made, but this is mostly being stirred up by ambitious rivals is how corruption is normalized. It's not the role of the media or pundits to make excuses.
I'm not making excuses. I'm telling it the way it is. Why is that an excuse? I said he made a mistake. He did make a mistake. So the letter writer acknowledges that. I don't know what else to say.
All right. Now for the nice ones. As I sneeze. Okay. Thank you, Alan. You have said exactly what I was thinking. I'm furious with Governor Cuomo for being such a muttonhead about this entire situation. He should have just held his tongue and been contrite.
My mother used to say to me, Alan, mind your bee and hold your tea. Mind your business and hold your tongue.
Yep.
Certainly, that would have been good advice for somebody to give to Andrew here. The last thing he should have been doing now is getting into a personal vindictive fight with Assemblyman Kim, who obviously is going to make out like a bandit among all the people who don't like Andrew here. He'll become a hero. Why in the world would Andrew do that? But he did it, and that's all I got to say about that.
And the other letter is from James, who says, really? An investigation over a reporting error? Alan is right. The circular firing squad is beginning. That from James.
There you go.
Go ahead.
So can I just make one quick comment?
Of course.
On that? You know, I do think that there's a lot of confusion over what happened, and that a lot of people think he was hiding the total death numbers. And I think it's important to make it clear that the total number of people who died was still the same. It was whether they had been attributed to hospitals or nursing homes that's really the issue. So that's not to excuse it or anything, but you know, I've talked to a lot of people who didn't understand that it really is, as it were, an accounting error. I think it may be a little more than that, but you know, that's the primary issue.
Well, there's another issue here. I have to say, I'm going to get into a lot of trouble with this, but then why avoid that? Part of this has to be laid at the door of the press. You know, Andrew can be tough on the press, no question. That's why I have given him the name Tough Guy Andrew. And now is a time that the press is going to run like this with like a dog with a bone in their mouth. They are playing this like, you know, it's an extraordinary event. It isn't. He made a stupid mistake. I think he may have learned from it. I hope he's learned from it. Melissa DeRosa probably learned something from it. But what really has happened here is the press says, boy, this is a big story. This is an international story. Do you remember, guys, when Cuomo was talking about how Italians were treated with me on the air?
Yes.
And he used the N-word.
Correct.
And it was in no way an egregious error. He just used it. My father told me, Alan,
he was making
never ever use that word. Yeah, go ahead, Joe. You were going to say
no. I was just clarifying that he was using it as an example and used the word instead of saying the N-word. Yes, go ahead.
That's right. And it became news in Ethiopia. It became news in Italy. It was unbelievable. So this is the guy who makes headlines if he says something. I don't know that it was a mistake, but he got into terrible trouble for doing it. He has to know that this is going to happen.
Well, let me just say that this is what Alan's referring to is what made this week's Media Project 3-1. And rather than recount the entire argument, I invite people to listen Sunday night.
Good point, Ira.
Oh, now my curiosity has piqued. Anything you'd
There's
like to say?
There's a lot of yelling and screaming.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Mostly by me.
Linda, anything you'd like to add to this conversation before we move off this topic?
No, I said in the beginning on this one, I agree with Alan on Cuomo. He made a stupid mistake. He should have apologized for it, not gotten in the fight with Kemp. I'm in agreement here. I have nothing to add.
All right. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll go to a new topic. We do welcome your letters, and we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Jim Henler, Ira Fosfeld. Oh, Malia, did you have anything to say? I'm sorry. I apologize. I forgot to ask.
That's fine. Thanks. I'm not an expert on state politics, but I agree entirely with what Linda just said.
Excellent. Okay. I'm sorry. I completely blanked. Anyway, Malia Dumont is here and Linda Ellerbe. We will be back with the whole crew, and I'll even remember that they're all here when we come back right after this. Now, baby, you thrill me. I preface this story, which we're about to discuss, with the question of how much should we be making of this, but it is the top story in the Washington Post this morning, so I read it, and I'm interested in what the panel has to say. Anthony Fauci, the country's leading infectious disease expert, has said Americans can expect a return to normalcy by this fall. President Biden suggested on Tuesday that a better estimate for a return to the pre-pandemic normal would be Christmas. Both goals came long after the end of July, when Biden promises there will be enough vaccine doses for every American, which is the benchmark that many people have believed would allow life to return to its normal course. As the country approaches the one-year mark of the pandemic isolation and restrictions, the Biden administration is struggling to give precise, consistent answers to two key questions. When will the pandemic truly be behind us? And short of that, when can children safely return to school? Biden himself has blamed miscommunication for some of his inconsistency, but his administration, which has promised to use science and data as the basis for pivotal decisions, is also grappling with the fact that science and data don't produce answers as tidy or linear as campaign promises. Alan, what do you make of this situation?
Well, you know, this is incredibly serious stuff. People really want to send their kids back to school. They can't go to work. They can't go to a classroom in so many cases, although that's being changed now. An estimate of when normalcy will occur is terribly important. I can't say anything except that we all want it to happen. And we don't want to make mistakes and cause a resurgence of the virus. Look, if you're a politician right now, you just got your finger up in the wind and you're hoping that, you know, you can point it some way without getting other people wet. Is that an analysis?
That's good. I like that, actually. The issue of I've been watching some coverage this week, and I don't know. I was watching Jake Tapper 2 days ago. And he was really taking the president to task on this and saying that, you know, we were shifting all over the place. And I don't know. I found myself bristling because I don't know the initially. Well, two things. One, initially when the president said we can do 1 million shots a day, everyone said, well, that's too ambitious. You know, you shouldn't make promises you can't keep. And then he upped it to 1.5. Well, currently in this country, we're vaccinating 1.7 million people. Now, we all, obviously, as we've previously discussed, there are many, many problems with that system, but the number remains what it is and looks only to be able to get better. There is that. Also, when President Trump talked about schools and the closure of schools and that we should reopen them, all hell broke loose. We obviously know more now than we know then, but it still seems to not acknowledge that there are great issues with the schools and with the teachers and with the parents, I think is underestimating the issue. Linda, what do you think?
I think our problem, Joe, all along has been overestimating and estimating at all. Start with Donald Trump's, this will just disappear one day.
Yeah. There has been
an approach by what seems to me a chamber of commerce mentality that says if we say this is not a problem or if we say it's going to be fixed in a month or so, then that will make it so. I think our wanting politicians to predict things that they cannot reasonably predict at this point is ridiculous. we keep having to lower our own expectations. Well, no, it wasn't done by last summer. Gee, it wasn't done by Christmas. And no, it wasn't back to the new normal by spring, and it's not going to be. And now we're sitting and discussing whether it's July or August, whether it's August or December. Isn't it clear from the past that it's going to be longer than anyone wants it to be and that anyone is predicting? And even to reach the herd immunity, we have to account for the anti-vaxxers. We haven't even begun to do that. Right now, we're just trying to get shots in the arms of people who actually want those shots. As far as getting back to school, as far as a new normal, I say if you say 2022, you're probably closer to right, but probably still underestimating it.
That's a great point. Jim, you watch the data. What do you think?
Yeah, I very much agree with Linda. You know, the problem is everybody's looking for the same kind of quick fix, and it's that quick fix thinking that's part of what got us in trouble in the first place with the bad handling by the previous administration. You know, we have not only 50 different states, all of which are doing different things, but we also have parts of states that have, you know, look at upstate New York versus downstate New York, right? When you're in the city, you're going to have a different situation when it comes to some of their huge public schools versus the size of ours up here. And, you know, everyone's talking like, well, there'll just be a magic day where everyone says, go back to school. And it's not going to be like that. There's going to be rolling things going on. We're going to have some form of masking and social distancing for longer than when, you know, a large number of people are vaccinated. And, you know, it's going to be a health problem we learn to live with, but it's not like there's a day when just magically everything goes away. And people are talking like, you know, we'll open all the schools on this Tuesday in June. It's just not going to be like that.
And yet there is a contemporary debate that is happening right this second, right? So a lot of people are saying, open the schools now. I can't work. I can't live this way. And there are places that are opening their schools.
Why don't they just open daycare centers if it's all about their work?
Yeah. Well, what's the difference between a daycare center and a school?
Well, that is the issue, isn't it?
Well, and
it's an issue.
You know, and then, I mean, we're having debates over school. I mean, just look at the local news here. We're having debates over high impact sports, of whether kids should go back to that. And some aren't going to class, but they are engaging in sports. Some health departments in some counties are allowing it in areas. Others aren't. Some schools have voted it down. Most schools are saying go ahead with it. So it's sort of all over the place. And it's hard to figure out, you know, the best thing to do in all of that. Malia, I could be unfair and ask you about, you're probably the one, I mean, I realize that when we talk about schools, we're not talking about colleges and universities, but certainly there are crossovers to what you're dealing, or what you're dealing with at Bard.
Yeah, so I'm going to say something controversial.
Oh, good.
Cool.
Roll the tape, Mike.
Opening schools is not as dangerous as a lot of people fear. And recognizing that there are important differences between colleges and schools, I still think there are instructive things that we can take from the experience we've had at Bard, which is we have been in person, and we've brought 1,500 students from around the world back to Bard safely. We had one COVID case last semester. We have a few more this semester so far, but it's very contained, and we've had no outbreak. And we're not the only place that's doing in-person teaching that's experiencing the ability to contain things. Going back to another thread of this conversation, there was a lot of uncertainty before a vaccine was in place, but I think the arrival of the vaccine lessens the uncertainty. It becomes less about trying to contain infection and getting people vaccinated. And there are systems in place for that, and governments are responsible for putting those systems in place. I know there's a lot of complexity. You know, I've worked in the federal government, but it should be pretty straightforward and more predictable and more within government's power than trying to figure out, you know, all the masking and right. before we understood the whole spread of the virus before. So, I don't believe this is going to continue through 2022 necessarily, but I do hope that some masking remains in place, because I have to say the instance of flu and cold and other things on campus, students visiting our health service for those things has dropped dramatically because of the masking.
Alan?
So has Bard insisted that every student who can gets vaccinated?
Well, our students, other than students who have comorbidities, are not yet eligible. So only those who have comorbidities, they became eligible on Monday of this week. But we don't know when our students will be eligible to be vaccinated.
Well, put another way, when you do know when they are available, will you in fact insist in order to come
yes,
to this college you do that? Yes, that's the question.
Gene says,
"Well, I'm glad to. I don't know whether it was controversial, but I'm glad to hear what Malia said about what's going on at Bard. Far be it from me to think I know more than the experts on this, but it just seems to me that under the right conditions, that if the rules are followed, if people are masked and distanced, etc., we all know the drill, that it's safe to open these schools. We've all gone to places where." You know, they take your temperature on the way in the door, and they insist that you're wearing masks. It's my understanding from what I've read that schools are a lot safer than in many other areas of society, and it just surprises me that there aren't more schools open. I don't think one size fits all makes any sense, but there are certain places that know how to do it, and they're going to do it right, and they're going to be careful. And then one other point, just to personalize it, both of my grandsons in Los Angeles are going to private school, and it's been open, and you know, the only difference between private school and a public school is the money, but you still have to take care of yourself. You still have to follow the precautions, and knock wood, so far so good. So it can be done, and I'm not quite sure why it hasn't been done.
So, are you paying for the private schools?
Oh, I have a son and a daughter-in-law.
who are doing better than you. Right?
The short answer is yes, they pay for private school.
So, Ira, let me just point out that, you know, I think the issue is when we look at the data, it's a mess. And part of the reason is because it depends what you look at. If we're talking about are the kids getting sick, that's completely different than are the kids bringing stuff home and other people getting sick. Mm-hmm. We do see clusters in places they've opened schools that we're not seeing in other places. The problem is most of the places that open schools have also done other things. Opened other things, let people go to bars at night. So it's really, really hard to figure out what's causing the problems.
But are you saying?
There's general agreement that there's not a lot of danger to the kids in schools, particularly in the lower grades, because of the weirdness of this virus in terms of it's not really impacting kids so much. But it's what will that do to community spread prior to when we have a higher level of vaccination? And I'm not saying we know the answer to that. The answer is we don't know the answer to that. And that's why a lot of people are still urging caution about opening the schools. Ira, will you get sick because your son gets it from their kid and brings it to you? That's what people are worried about.
But you're supposed to, this is a program where you're supposed to give your, you know, opinion, your definition. It's demanded of you, right, Joe? So that sounds like,
my opinion is that the easy answer stuff won't work in this case because it's a hard answer. We don't know it yet. The bad thing about science and data is we only know what's happening. We can't make it
so
up.
So why talk?
So Gene writes and says, I'm tired of the question, when can schools safely reopen? The answer is they can reopen. The question should be, when will government fully fund schools so they can afford the staff, COVID testing, vaccines, and square footage to pay for it? So we'll leave that note, and we will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more topics to discuss. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jim Hendler, Ira Fussfeld, Malia Dumont, and Linda Ellerbe making up the panel this morning. We're thrilled to have you all with us. So Rush Limbaugh passed away yesterday, the right-wing radio megastar whose slashing, divisive style of mockery and grievance reshaped American conservatism, denigrating Democrats, environmentalists, feminazis, his term, and other liberals, while, yes, predicting the rise of Donald Trump. He died on Wednesday at his home in Palm Beach, Florida. He was 70 years old, died of lung cancer. He revealed the diagnosis last February. He became a singular figure in the American media, fomenting mistrust, grievances, and even hatred on the right for Americans who did not share their views. And he pushed baseless claims and toxic rumors long before Twitter and Reddit became havens for such disinformation. In politics, he was not only an ally of Mr. Trump, but also a precursor, combining media fame, right-wing scare tactics, and over-the-top showmanship to build an enormous fan base and mount attacks on truth and facts. Who would like to begin?
Oh, I'll take a shot at it.
Okay.
You know, we all know that
You go first.
All right, Ira, then Linda.
We all know that the protocol is not to speak ill of the dead, and I'm afraid that Rush Limbaugh is going to have to be an exception to that. I mean, it's not just that he was a conservative who I disagreed with. There are a lot of conservatives who I would mourn if they died, but this guy is not one of them. You know, I invite people to read the entirety of the Obit in the Times today and to get the full flavor if you have never listened to him or you only know him peripherally. But this guy did a lot to really divide this country. I'm sorry, Rush. I'm not sorry to see you go.
Linda? I was calling on you. Yes, go ahead.
And I'm not apologetic for how I feel about that either. I don't think one should be. I know that a lot of people have misquoted Mark Twain on this event or told the Betty Davis story, and I personally go with the Betty Davis story, apocryphal though it may be, the story that when informed of Joan Crawford, a woman she intensely disliked, when informed of her death, Betty Davis said, and I will not try to do the accent, "I'm told one should speak only good of the dead." So, Joan is dead. Good. And that's good. I stand with Miss Davis on Rush, and I do not apologize for it. Why would anybody apologize for defending their own self-interest? I am a woman, I am a feminist, and I also knew Rush Limbaugh, and Rush didn't believe the nonsense. He did not believe what he put out on the air, for the most part. He truly did not. And he spent an extraordinary flight one day where we ended up seated next to one another purely by accident of an airline. And we had a very long ride. Let me just tell you that Rush was so much like Donald Trump. Rush was a damaged child. He clearly wasn't loved enough. He was David Bowder, a friend of mine at the AP, really said it well in a piece today where he talked about that Bowder was a loner who disliked school, longed in vain for popularity. He was bullied, as Trump was bullied by his father, and he grew up to be a man who desperately wanted and sought approval and popularity at all price and power. Rush didn't have a system of beliefs. He had a desire for money and power, and he pretty much was not very good at his job until he stumbled on hate and discovered that he could ride it to become a millionaire, a multimillionaire, become rich beyond his dreams, and become a kingmaker in his own mind and become a powerhouse in this country. And to the extent, let me give you just a tiny detail that tells you how deeply the Rush Limbaugh effect settles into our country. The first obituary of Rush Limbaugh that appeared in the New York Times yesterday said the following phrase. He called women who favored abortion feminazis.
Right.
Now, women don't favor abortion. Today that line was changed, quite rightly, to he called women who defended abortion rights feminazis. But just look at that tiny error. The New York Times felt perfectly calm in saying he called women who favored abortion feminazis. The power of Rush Limbaugh has extended so far into our country. Yesterday, Rosemary posted something about, you know, gee, would it make me a bad person if I said I'm kind of okay with Rush dying? And there were people that went on there and said, yes, that would make you a bad person.
Yeah.
And also, you're a Democrat, and Democrats and patriots aren't patriots, and liberal. They don't love their country. They fear truth. Well, these ideas come straight out of Rush. It's just an anti-everything, but it's not anti-everything. It's anti-everything but white male domination. And over, that is what comes out of Rush Limbaugh's mouth. The angry old white male who sees his power going away to those of us who are female, those of us who are people of color, those of us who are indigenous people, all of the others. It's not against any one group. It is about the preservation of power of one single group, the white patriarchal society. I am delighted Rush Limbaugh is dead.
You know, I have to say, Linda, you know, nothing you say has surprised me, but I think I agree with you. One of the things I find so interesting about what you say, though, is that popularity. He was saying the things he was, and the more hate, the more popular he got. I mean, he went from 200 to 400 to 600 stations in a flick, and he knew it, and he would just dole out more and more and more because it meant more stations and, well, obviously more money and more power.
Well, it is always easier to burn down a barn than build one.
Yeah.
And 73 million people voted for Trump.
Right.
Yeah.
That's all you got to know.
And, you know, this attitude in obituaries, in far too many of the obituaries that I have been reading, for example, President George W. Bush, now I'm not a supporter there either, called Limbaugh a friend who, quote, spoke his mind as a voice for millions of Americans. Well, that implies that hate is just another point of view. Well, it's not just another point of view. Hate speech is hate speech. That we frame it as, oh, it's just another legitimate point of view. Bad on us for that. Bad on us. He used it to sell and to make money. And he wanted the same approval Trump wanted. He wanted the approval of the New York Times. He wanted the approval of the, quote, intellectuals of this country. He didn't get that. So he went for the approval of people whom he did not like, and he did not like those people. And he said as much to me on two separate occasions. He didn't like those people.
Mm.
But he found he could use those people to get what he did like and want and need, which was popularity, money, and power. Sound like somebody else we know?
Malia, you were...
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to cut in on
that. No, not at all.
I was just going to say, like, the mean-spiritedness that characterized everything that Rush said, and also the lack of respect for his own listeners, that he knowingly told them untruths, knowing they would believe him. Just the cynicism, really disturbing. I'll never forget the first and only time I listened to Rush Limbaugh was the day after 9/11, and this was not by my personal choice, but I was in Army training at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and all military bases around the country had been locked down. So our instructors were not able to get on base to instruct us. So we were kept busy the entire day pulling weeds out of cracks and sidewalks. Not joking. And one of the sergeants in my class pulled his truck up next to where we were doing that and had Rush Limbaugh on the radio. So that was the soundtrack for our weed pulling duties. And you can he was saying the day after 9/11. So I knew that's why I didn't need to listen to him again. But I think he's clearly he's the vanguard of a whole group of conservative radio hosts and now talk show hosts and other opinion makers who use the same tactics he did. And I think it's time for discussion of whether we should be looking at the fairness doctrine that used to be in use at the Federal Communications Commission. It was introduced in 1949, but eliminated in 1987. I'm not totally familiar with all the ins and outs of and pros and cons of it, but clearly it was it required broadcasters to devote some of their airtime to discuss matters of public interest and to air contrasting views regarding those matters. And it just strikes me that the loss of this fairness doctrine has weakened public discourse in this country.
Well, and he admitted as much. He said that once the fairness doctrine went away, he could go ahead and say whatever he wanted and didn't have to worry about having the other side on, and was testing the limits every day as to what he could get away with, which is why it just got worse and worse and worse as time went on, as to the hate that Linda mentioned earlier. Jim, anything you want to say on this?
I wish I could think of anything to add to what Linda said, but that was eloquent and captures it so well.
Go ahead.
It did. I would just like to add something to what you said, because when you mentioned that he was unfair to his listeners by what he said, yes, yes, yes. A friend of mine wrote me a note, and she said, Rush was a person who lived a really ugly life and caused so much harm to all of us, but especially to the people who listened to him, says my friend. And I believe she's right.
It's a difficult legacy. I also, to unpack, because, you know, I also was just starting out in radio in that time. And there were AM/FM stations that I was working at, and they were going under. And all of a sudden, Rush comes in, and if you had that show on your air, the station survived. You got money, and suddenly, you know, Rush became this great hero in the radio world because he was saving radio stations left and right. And of course, there were many of us that were saying, okay, but at what cost? And of course, that didn't enter the equation. But it was complicated, because people would say, all right, well, you know, we have to go out, and then all of a sudden they'd put on Rush, and the ratings would quadruple, and all of a sudden the ad revenue just went through the roof. And I guess that's the scariest part of it, that there was such an audience, and continued to be right up until his final program. Alan, anything you'd like to add to that?
No, like the others, I'm staying with Linda. I thought that was eloquent and wonderful and comprehensive, and there wasn't a thing I could add to it.
All right. We welcome your letters.
I would like to just add one thing.
Sure.
Myself. What we are talking about, and we need to ask ourselves why this was so popular, what we're talking about, and it plays off something I said earlier, but let's nail it down, really. The historian Rick Perlman, who writes books about modern conservatism, I read an interview with him yesterday, and he talks about that what Rush did, and Joe, your evidence that it really worked. It really worked. What he's promoting is not just a white male preservation philosophy, but a white male Southern civil rights era preservationist philosophy.
Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. We have
Southern civil rights era, and it works across the entire country, apparently. That's how deeply racist we are.
You know,
Joe? I just wanted to say about the fairness
doctrine. And misogynist and homophobic.
Go ahead. Fairness doctrine. Yes, Alan.
I just wanted to say that I have grave doubts about reinstituting the fairness doctrine. This program could not be what it is, for example, if every 2 seconds or every time you had, you know, said something that smacked of liberalism or progressivism, you would have to have somebody on doing the exact opposite, and it would water down the station. I understand the argument for it, and I understand how much bigger Rush Limbaugh was than little WAMC. But I have to say, I have grave doubts about it.
We have letters on Rush, so let me read them. Nick says, no one person has done more damage to America these past 40 years than Rush Limbaugh. William says, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, conservatives across the board praised her for being a trailblazer and offered their condolences. When Rush dies, the left dances on his grave as the media writes hit pieces disguised as an obit. Limbaugh is hated by the left for being so effective. R.I.P. Rush, says William. Russell says, imagine a panel of academics reveling in the death of Rush Limbaugh. Enjoy your moment. Your bias is showing. Shame on you all. Julius, Limbaugh was the original king of cancel culture. Good riddance. Fortunately, God imposes term limits. Ricky says, rest in peace, Rush Limbaugh, who, along with other right-wing media personalities, is more responsible than anyone else for publicizing the lie that the 2020 election was stolen. Rush Limbaugh and others on the same radio station. We go to Kisti, who says, thank you for resisting speaking sweetly of the dead panel. He is the vanguard of the mainstream hate movement. Rest in you-know-what, Limbaugh. Jeff says, I and many others have been donating to Planned Parenthood in Rush Limbaugh's memory. It's what he would have wanted. If you're on Instagram, you can donate. All right. Rush had a segment on his show where he would read out the names of gay men dying of AIDS and then laugh about it. The gay community has nothing good to say about him. Tom says, my late father was a Rush Limbaugh fan, not quite one of his ditto heads, but a regular listener all the same. My father had several Rush's Right bumper stickers, one of which I purloined and used a patch of another stick to cover the word right with wrong and happily taped it to the front of my bedroom door. Surprisingly, it amused Dad, who grinned and laughed the first time he saw it. Mom, from a family of Roosevelt Democrats, hated that Dad was so enraptured by Rush, but she never hesitated to challenge Dad on his Rush-based opinions. Initially, Rush and my dad were united in common causes, their unending hatred of Bill Clinton. My father and I used to ride to and from work together in the summer when I was a student because we both worked for the University of Buffalo. For most of the rides home after work, I thankfully had my Sony Walkman and a book with me. By the way, let's not forget that just about a year ago, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, for whatever that's worth. I will mention that. I think I got most of the letters. All right.
I just say I'm glad that one of the pieces of news that was reported earlier this week is that the Pentagon had delayed pushing forward the nominations of two female generals to four-star commands. And I can just imagine how they would have been treated by Rush Limbaugh on his show. Trump's own Secretary of Defense decided to delay pushing these nominations forward under Trump because he thought they wouldn't receive a fair hearing.
What are they saying about who's going to replace him?
I was just going to ask that. No, I don't know.
I wonder whether Trump will be an occasional host.
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I wondered about that, too. It seemed to me that that was a way he could make back some of that money he owes everybody.
Got to work 3 hours a day, though, talking.
Wasn't there some jerk from around here who started here, I think GY?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And who has benefited from the Rush legacy by being foul-mouthed.
There were two, actually. I believe. I know the one you're talking about. And then there was another one after that. One had issues, and the other one, I don't know exactly where.
I think one went national.
Yeah, they both went national. But I don't know if they still are. That's my... I'm looking it up right now. Mike Gallagher was the guy's name. Mike Gallagher. political commentator and American radio host, conservative Mike Gallagher show.
And then there was another one, Joe.
Yeah.
With a name that wasn't his.
Right. That's the one I know he had issues. Yeah. And there again, I can't. Anyway, doesn't matter.
We'll get 700 letters.
You're right. It wasn't his name, and I don't remember the air name. But he was on for both with GY and WGY, our first radio station, right, in the country.
Wasn't it? At one point, it was a very respectable radio.
That's right. And then Ran Rush, and then would have the conservative view that came in after, with these local shows. One being Mike Gallagher, the aforementioned Mike Gallagher. Okay, let's see. I think we have a couple more. I just have a minute
before
here.
We leave. Yes. Can I just point out that one of your letters was factually inaccurate?
Not the first time, but go ahead. I said not the first time, but go ahead.
Yeah, the conservatives were not gentle and kind when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. There were many of them who called it God's punishment because she favored a woman's right to control when she became a mother. There were others. Rush's own website put up a joke about it, whether it was Rush or not, because he had cancer at that time, and it still remains up on it. So let's be clear. This is not the conservatives were so heartwarming and respectful when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and now you leftists are. But no, that is not what's happening here. People who do not favor hate are fairly happy that Rush Limbaugh is no longer among the living and pushing hate actively for profit on the air.
But
end of me talking on that subject.
All right. Well, we'll take a break there then. That's a fine place. When we come back, we'll finish up and talk about other subjects. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We just ask that they're short and to the point, and we would love to see what you have to say. Alan Shartok, Jim Hendler, Ira Fussfeld, Malia Dumont, and Linda Ellerby all on the program this morning. We'll continue after this.
Will there smile in your face? Same time they'll be taking your dough.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Shartok, Jim Hendler, Ira Fussfeld, and Linda Ellerby. Malia Dumont of Bard was with us, and she did have to leave during the break, so we thank her for her participation. Had to go teach, so we'll let her do that, doing honorable work. So we thank her. She'll be back next week, I believe, so we look forward to hearing from her then. She was upset. I was just talking to her that wasn't going to be able to join in on the Texas conversation. So let us go to Texas. I will say, if you were listening yesterday, we read a letter from Linda Ellerby who wrote who was amused by us trying to figure out Texas. Of course, that's your home state, Linda. And so how does this story strike you?
Well, it strikes me in many different ways, but the obvious and most interesting current moment has to do is rather like the Rush cynicism. Ted Cruz and his family got on a plane to Cancun, Mexico last night. It is 83 degrees in Cancun, yep. Mexico. If you want to discuss cynicism, Ted Cruz is a man who knows full well that Donald Trump lost the election, but allowed people to believe otherwise for his own cynical purposes. His state, 3 million people are without heat right now, and he has gotten on a plane to Mexico with his family. As far as understanding Texas, that is probably beyond me, too, and I am a Texan. One must learn to live with certain inconsistencies in Texas. But trying to put this blowback on clean energy is outrageous. This is on Texas exceptionalism, on its feeling that it is exceptional, that the rules for everywhere else simply do not apply. Texas. Well, you know, guess what? They do apply. They apply in this as well as they apply in COVID.
So, Linda, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jim.
I would never disagree with you on that. And I, but in fact, the rules are different in Texas. Texas created its own energy system in such a way that they would not be forced into the federal rules on purpose. And, you know, Joe, it came out yesterday on your show. People were talking about the, you know, the Texans were saying this is a 100-year event and et cetera, et cetera. 10 years ago in early February, this happened. 21 years ago in early February, this happened. In both of those cases, the federal government said in reports, in writing, that if Texas was federally under the federal regulation, they would have to make the following changes. Every single one of those changes that were recommended 10 years ago, guess how many Texas made? Answer, none. Guess what those what the prediction was if they didn't make those changes, that they would have exactly what happened, that their generators wouldn't hold up, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's you know, this, ooh, we couldn't possibly have expected this. Not only did they expect it, they knew it was coming, and they cynically decided to ignore it.
And now you have the governor, Abbott, basically saying it's all the fault of the providers when he knew, as you are saying, what had to be done. And by the way, Linda, I have to take some exception with you about Cruz. You know, after all, it's not surprising he went to Cancun because he is the son of a beach.
Okay. Whoa. Yeah. All right. Let me also just point out that I was not saying Texas didn't have its own rules. That I agree with you. That is what got them into this problem. I meant that the universe doesn't care about Texas exceptionalism,
yes,
whether it's climate change or coronavirus, was what the point I was trying to make. You're quite right. This is a self-inflicted wound, and there is some irony and perhaps a little humor, except that people are dying and suffering because of this. And watching Greg Abbott try to, as the song says in the best little whorehouse in Texas, do the little dance, the little sidestep. Now you see me, now you don't. Woo-hoo, have it both ways. He and Cruz both are doing that right now.
Well,
it's a shame they're doing it at the expense of Texas citizens. On the other hand, Texas citizens are the very ones who insist on their exceptionalism.
There was
some talk, Linda, about Texas changing sides last time, and that there was a sense that, you know, Trump could have lost in Texas, which he did not do, of course.
Oh, I agree with you. My mission is to help turn Texas blue by the next election, because the cities are already blue in Texas. And the thing that keeps most ground organizing from happening the way it did in Georgia is simply distance. People forget how big Texas is. You're not talking about a place where you have another town every 15 miles. Organizing on the ground will take us a whole bunch of Stacey Abrams, but you know what? They exist. It can be done. Texas can be turned purple. If not blue, it's already purple.
How does an issue like this expedite that, do you think?
Well, in order to get people to believe the truth, you have to first stop getting them to believe lies. I believe it's happening, quite frankly. As bad as this weather crisis is there, perhaps it will cause a few people. I actually have four different friends in Texas who have changed their politics since 2016 because of what they have seen happen under Trump. Now, that's anecdotal evidence, and please, I'm not trying to extrapolate beyond that, but that is four in Texas that have changed.
Mm-hmm.
That's a start. There are many starts all over Texas like that, just starting to question the nonsense they've been being fed.
Some of the negatives, this from the New York Times report on this. Such appraisals come at a time when Greg Abbott, the Republican governor, was already under fire for his handling of the pandemic. Even before thawing, freezers forced health officials in Houston to scramble this week to administer thousands of vaccine doses. Latino leaders in hard-hit South Texas were pleading with Mr. Abbott to allow city officials along the border to put into place stricter mitigation measures. At the same time, a steady drip of other scandals has focused scrutiny on the Republicans wielding power at the state level in Texas. Ken Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, remains under a cloud of legal trouble as he responds to abuse of power claims, including a lawsuit by former aides who say he took bribes from a real estate developer. The Republican-dominated Texas legislature is also no stranger to intrigue. In one episode, a secret audio recording in 2019 by a conservative activist showed that Dennis Bonin, the former Speaker of the Texas House, plotting against fellow Republicans by seeking to enlist the support of hardline activists to take them down in primary challenges. All kinds of good intrigue going on there.
Well, you know, I will never understand how a politician who sees all of their colleagues nationwide going down, whether it's Shelley Silver or anybody else, for taking a bribe, continue to do it. I just don't understand why anybody would put themselves in that kind of a situation, but they do.
I guess because more people get away with it than get caught.
A lot of what Linda says is interesting, but when she talked about turning Texas purple, that helps crystallize in my mind a little bit as to why Abbott would go out and try to blame AOC or the Green New Deal on this crisis when it's clearly it has nothing to do with the crisis. And I suspect that there are millions of people in Texas who are looking at their government and not looking at it very fondly right now. And the option to go to the other team may look a lot more likely or at least doable than it once was. We in the Northeast are used to power outages. Knock wood, it's usually not for only longer than a few hours at a time. But I know in recent years we've had several days' worth of outages, whether it's summer or winter. And nothing troubles me more thinking about the potential of power outages for what it means to our lives in ways real and not so real. And thinking about all these people right now in Texas, with the temperature being what it is, not having any power is just shocking is not the right word. It's sickening, I guess, is the better one. And it's somebody needs to be called to account on it.
And it's funny because while the Republicans are saying that, you know, blaming it on wind and so forth, they're also saying that, you know, now is not the time to blame anybody. It's also time to get everything, you know, take care of these people. And yet
just like continues. They say after every shooting now,
right.
let's do prayers and wishes. And it's not the time to discuss the issue.
The two states that get me the most are Florida and Texas, because no matter what goes wrong, they keep electing those Republicans.
Well, for 26 years, Alan, that's not forever. It can change. Little hope.
You are so right. It can
we
change.
We have hope.
It was a Democrat state when I was growing up in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you think of Ann Richards
but
being governor of that
1964
state.
1964 came along and all of the southern states stopped being Democrat because it became about race.
And Lyndon Johnson said it. He said, I've just given the, you know,
yep,
the South.
For the next 100 years.
Yeah,
and
right.
He's been proven correct so far. It hasn't been 100 years, though.
No, and there is Georgia.
Yeah.
Only so far. Georgia is a beacon for Texas.
Right, you are.
We have a few minutes, and we have a couple of letters here from earlier conversations. This one on schools. Jones says, I think there's a difference between in-person education or private schools, which probably have room to spread out in schools of 25 to 30 or more students in a classroom with little or no alternative space or poor ventilation. Really depends on the physical layout available. Sarah says, bravo, Alan. Early child care in K-12 should not be separated. Many 0-5 programs have been open and fracturing under the weight of the pandemic. We have made the young children the canaries. The staff have been coping with opening and closing with every scare and positive case. Early child care providers need to be seen.
I think, you know, that's sort of what I was talking about. And, you know, Alan, you were asking me to say something more direct, you know. Look at the bi-county in New York. We have counties like, up here in Albany, our 14-day average is right around 2%. You look down in the mid-Hudson, you've got numbers like 6 and 7%. When you say we want, you know, even a statewide policy, you have to go look at this microcluster. There's a huge difference in disease spread between, you know, it may not seem like 2% versus 6% is a big difference. It's a huge difference.
You know,
when you look at a New York City public school in the Bronx, where it's 6%, and you look at a you know, an Albany public school and just compare the square footage per student, it's a different story. I would love to see the kids back in school. Don't get me wrong. But I'm saying we really have to look at that school by school, district by district, state by state.
Oh.
Well, I keep thinking, as a grandparent myself, kids are going to school or to nursery school or where they're 6 years old. You know, if it's your kid and it's 1%, and it could be your kid, it means a great deal to you when you try to dope all of this stuff out. It's that simple.
Erica writes and says, first of all, why would anyone answer a question you need a crystal ball for? What if one of the facilities has an issue? This is about the president's response, I think. Why would anyone answer a question you need a crystal ball for? What if one of the facilities has an issue? What if states have logistical issues? How about just saying we can't answer the question with any accuracy due to many variables? On schools, again, to act like a school in the Bronx, for example, that has terrible ventilation, two working bathrooms and overcrowded classrooms in a school in L.A. that has everything it needs, schools open together, is ridiculous. And how about reminding everyone the feds have no authority to make schools open? That from listener Erica. We go to Liz, who said...
And yet, Joe, the president of the United States has a great deal of influence. And if the president says, I think schools should be reopened, or if a governor says, I think schools should be reopened, it means a great deal, power or not.
Liz says, kids do belong in school. Teachers belong in school. That's where we all want to be. So vaccinate the teachers. Don't spend money on face shields. If the teachers are vaccinated, that provides the best protection. Kids are good with masks. Social distancing is impossible in school. Ventilation is generally archaic in school. So vaccinate the teachers. Get one shot in their arms and open up the schools. It's simple. Vaccinate.
I agree.
All right.
Go
ahead, Jim.
I wish I agreed, but that's not what the data shows yet.
What are you saying?
You know, would we be better if we vaccinated? And do we need the kids back in school? I say yes. But again, move carefully, because if the schools become the hearts of super spreaders and clusters, we all shut down again. You postpone the new normal.
On the other hand,
you know, postponing school a month so that everybody is safer may be a calculation we have to make by, you know, this spring.
30-second warning, but go ahead.
I'm with the unions. I think that the teachers have to be protected, period.
Absolutely.
But
what I'm arguing is that's not the panacea.
No.
That will help. That won't solve.
All right. We're going to pause. We're going to hold there because we're done. We're out of time.
No.
I want to thank everybody. Yeah, I know. We'll be back tomorrow. Alan, thank you very much, as always.
Thanks,
really good. Jim Hendler, Ira Fussfeld, Linda Ellerby, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me on, Joe.
Always
thank you,
a pleasure.
Joe.
We will talk soon, and we'll be back right after this.